tables will be turned. And let me guess, Renee said, you're going to kill me. Worse. Renee must have read something in Evan's voice, because he blinked a few times, regained his composure, forced a smile. Outside, a band of gold rode the horizon, tinting the caps of the snowbanks blue. Renee checked his watch. The markets are almost open. Are you ready to wire the money? Evan cleared his throat, spit a gob of blood on the pristine blue mat. No, he said. Renee gave a little nod and then breezed out, passing two of his men. Search him and bring him to the lab. 42. Corners of his mind. Straps bit into Evan's chest, stomach, and thighs, adhering him to the gurney. Hard leather restraints bound his ankles and wrists to the side rails. He fought to find a place inside himself that would protect him from what would come. Seer training had taught him to deal with stress, disorientation, torture. To this end, he'd been maced, electrocuted, and drown-proofed, his reactions observed and critiqued. He'd learned to find corners of his mind to retreat into. It never made the pain go away, but it allowed an extra layer between him and it, let him observe the agony from a slight remove. As with meditation, it was essential not to take his thoughts or sensations literally. He had to find the space around them. In the space, there was relief. From whatever Renee was readying over by the vault, Evan would be requiring a good deal of relief. Dex stood at Renee's side, but facing Evan, he held up his grinning hand, wore it over his mouth. I've tried to be reasonable, Renee said, but I've never come across anyone as stubborn as you. His back remained turned, his bowed shoulders rippling with some movement of his unseen hands. Daylight and frigid air streamed through the shattered basement window. I wanted this to be civilized, but you refused and refused and refused. And so now? He turned to face Evan, a syringe in hand. This. In the course of his training, Evan had been injected with sodium pentothal and other truth serums. He wondered if that was what Renee was up to here. A psychoactive medication would make him more pliable, more likely to be manipulated into sending the wire transfer and unleashing whatever came with it. But even as a kid, he'd found the drugs not to live up to their reputations. Judging by Dex's tattooed grin and Renee's very real one, whatever that syringe held was something much worse. I can promise, Renee said, as if reading Evan's mind. It's like nothing you've ever encountered. A fly buzzed over and landed on Evan's knuckles. He wiggled his fingers to scare it off. More sadistic research out of Cornell? Out of Oxford, actually. You wouldn't believe what it cost for me to procure a few tiny vials of this. Taking his time, Renee ambled closer to Evan. Like most experiments, it started with a simple question. What if you could make prison sentences for heinous crimes last longer? Evan's heart rate ticked up, pulsing in the side of his neck. Longer? Longer than a lifetime. Renee regarded the syringe with something like affection. There was a couple who kidnapped a 4-year-old boy. They kept him in a closet, tortured and starved him for weeks, then beat him to death. Given the UK's disdain for capital punishment, the husband and wife were given a 30-year sentence, which seems woefully inadequate. Evan thought of the Horizon Express, plowing along at 23 knots, a white furrow in the deep blue sea, and Alison Siegler somewhere aboard in one of 3,500 containers, closing the distance to a fate nobody deserved. And he thought of the boy's voice over the phone line. You should see how they keep us here. Like cattle, all lined up. Yes, he said. It does seem inadequate. What if you could make someone serve a 1,000-year sentence in 8 hours? 10 lifetimes of purgatory crammed into the span of a single workday. The tip of the needle neared. Evan's fear mounted, threatened to overtake him. Can you imagine the horror? Renee said, leaning in. Evan struggled furiously against the straps, but they were designed for precisely this purpose. The needle slid into his arm. Renee smiled. Don't worry, he said. I'm just going to give you a single Evan felt a slight pressure in his vein and then watched Renee's mouth continue to open more slowly than seemed conceivably possible. Each millimeter taking an hour, 2 hours, and the end of the spoken word pulled out and out, stretched from a block of steel into a thin metal wire, a sound and a vibration, the endless tunnel of the O like a wormhole through the ages. And over the forever gaping mouth, Renee started to blink. But the movement of his eyelids was like the rise and fall of a lake's watermark across the seasons. Limitless microseconds crammed between microseconds. The creased skin around his eyes rearranging infinitesimally. A universe of motion contained in a single blink. Until at last, after a day's grueling wait, Evan could see the thin blue veins etched in his closed lids, and he knew it would be another day for them to open yet again, and the word was not yet completed, the wrinkled lips still closing the O into the P, even as another sound overpowered the slow-motion hum of Renee's voice. A buzz slowed to its constituent audio parts, and Evan pulled his gaze to the source, but the shifting of his eyeballs felt like altering the course of a freight ship, ligaments and muscles flexing and tugging to recalibrate his view excruciatingly, until at last he fixed upon the bottle fly airborne over Renee, its hair-like bristles waving sluggishly on its metallic green thorax, its wings flapping so gradually that Evan could see the quality of light alter through the semi-transparent wings that were embellished with intricate patterns to put any stained glass window to shame, and the whole horrifying, unfettered, attenuated time, Evan's mind raced inside his skull at a real, frantic pace, alive and horror-filled, scrambling like a mouse trapped in a bowl of water, desperate, so desperate to get... He jerked his head back into the pillow, a breath screeching through his lungs. His muscles had knotted from neck to calves, arching his body against the restraints. He turned his head to the side and vomited, warmth drooling across his cheek onto the sheets. "I'll do it," he said in a voice so hoarse he didn't recognize it as his own. "I'll wire the money." 43. Unleash Hell. Evan sat before the monitor in the study on the fourth floor, his hands on the keyboard. The computer was brand new. He'd watched Halbador remove it from the box. That it was air-gapped, having never been hooked into the internet, was helpful. But whatever cloaking and encryption software Renee had in place to hide the wire transfers would not be as impenetrable and untraceable as those Evan used. He'd learned at the elbows of the best technical security specialists in the world, as had Van Sciver. Van Sciver had a team of them in his employ now, and more data mining capabilities than Renee could possibly dream of. Click a single button and unleash hell. Maybe unleashing hell was the only shot Evan had left. The heated vent above breathed warmth down his neck, making him break out in a sweat. Or was it fear, only now worming its way out through his skin? He'd spent so many years safe in obscurity, unseen and unexamined. Now the carefully positioned boulder he'd been hiding beneath was about to be rolled back, his life exposed to a blinding light. He thought about the infinity he'd spent strapped to the gurney, an infinity that had lasted precisely 2 flaps of a blowfly's wings. He looked over at Renee, a last-ditch effort. "You don't want me to do this." Renee smiled, folded his hands. "I don't. The wrong people will come. You will not be happy." "I've done this a time or two," Renee said. "My procedures are completely secure." Evan said, "You don't have any comprehension of what secure is." Renee snapped his fingers. With extreme caution, Dex handed him a syringe. The clear, viscous liquid rippled inside. A single drop had nearly undone Evan. He couldn't imagine what horrors a full injection would bring. Taking a deep breath, he keyed a series of passcodes into the Privatbank AG website. He paused. "Once I click this button, I can't control what will happen." Renee jammed the needle into the side of Evan's neck. He brought his ruddy face close, sweat drops clinging to the points of his hair. He spoke through locked teeth. "I am done negotiating." Evan felt the 21-gauge stainless steel tube embedded in his neck, a half-inch movement of Renee's thumb, and he'd be trapped in an eternity of suffering. He felt something leak out of him, the last of what he had. He closed his eyes, tapped the mouse. The loading wheel spun, and then a whoosh indicated that the money had gone. Renee eased the needle out of Evan's neck, and Evan allowed himself a quiet exhalation. He stared at the screen. Wire sent. "What's coming won't be worth $27 million, he said. Renee turned to Dex. "Put this animal back in its cage." Dex seized Evan, yanking him to his feet and shoving him toward the door. "At last," Evan said. "We're calling things what they are." 44. Celebration. Renee stood before the picture window of the master bedroom, hands clasped at the small of his back, watching snow flurry against the pane. It occurred to him that it was a pose suited to a Casseroy. Regal and imposing, spine held straight enough to disguise that 2-inch deviation. An artist could come along and paint an oil of him planted here victoriously, an oil that would have been worthy to hang alongside portraits of Casseroy's past that sobered the grand halls of his childhood manor. And yet, he had a niggling sense that it wasn't time to rest on his laurels. He'd prevailed in the battle, sure, but there was a greater war to be won. He felt a stirring, the sensation he got when he was closing in on a financial trail, readying for the kill. He closed his eyes, sensed the data shifting, so many bits and pieces, a pattern almost discernible just beneath the surface. Behind him, David stirred in the silk sheets, exhausted from the day's travails. "Are you coming to bed?" "Our guest is clearly not who I thought he was," Renee said, watching the snow shapeshift outside. "But I think he's something even bigger than I imagined." "What?" "I don't know," Renee said, finally turning. The rungs of David's stomach muscles stood out like something artificial, something poured from a mold. Renee was surprised by how little the sight aroused him. His office awaited. There were queries to be made, baited hooks to be tossed into the deep web. He walked past David, heading for the door. "But I'm going to start digging." The women's bathroom in Mexico City International Airport smelled of disinfectant and Montezuma's revenge. Candy wet a wad of paper towels in the sink and retreated behind a stall door. She peeled off her shirt and bra, the fabric clinging to her burn scars, then gingerly patted her weeping back with the damp towels. She allowed herself to grit her teeth, but did not make a noise. Relief? was relative. The pain was so constant that she sometimes forgot it was there. But not after an 18-hour flight spent leaning against a scratchy polyester seat cover. Sitting next to Jaggers, it only added to the agony. She hated everything about him. His stink, his jaundiced skin that under the yellow glow of the reading light looked like dried papaya, how he sucked his teeth after eating instead of using a toothpick. The way he'd killed a beautiful young fawn of a Tatar girl who'd only walked into the alley to see if they needed help. That the mission had proved to be a dead end only added to Candy's frustration. They'd laid over in Amsterdam already and would now enter the U.S. from the south, a not-worth-noticing commuter flight from Mexico City to San Diego. She was willing to endure any amount of hellacious travel and the myriad discomforts that came with it, as long as the journey held the faintest glimmer of hope for catching Orphan X. She'd forge through fire and brimstone to get a crack at his untarnished flesh. That's why she hated return flights. They spelled failure. She finished patting down her back and let the paper towels drop to the floor. Hanging her head, she eased a breath through her teeth. The air cooled the moist skin, a momentary break from the itching, the burn. Putting her shirt back on would be unpleasant. Gathering her will, she stared at the bra wrapped around her clenched fist. All her training. And here she was nearly vanquished by a 34D in a bathroom stall. A boarding announcement for her flight echoed through the bathroom. She readied herself to finish dressing. A vibration in her jeans caught her attention, the punk rendition of I'm Every Woman. Excitement licked up her spine. She clicked talk, held the phone to her cheek.
I have made your
next
reservation. Already?
You
have
to
eat
while
the meal
is
hot.
Gladly, she said. How hot is this particular meal? Piping. The lick of excitement turned to a tremor.
Particulars
to
follow,
spoke the chorus, and then Van Sciver clicked off. Grinning, Candy slid the phone back into her pocket. She pulled on her shirt and shoved through the stall door. On her way out of the bathroom, she dumped her bra in the trash. After all, this called for a celebration. 45. A different kind of ruckus. Hot water pounded the top of Evan's head, streaming down his shoulders. No matter how long he stayed in the shower, it seemed he could not get warm. His internal clock told him that it was a few hours past midnight. Renee seemed to be foregoing the sleeping gas, perhaps in honor of Evan's last night at Chalet Savoir Faire. Evan had been told that he would be hooded and driven away tomorrow, dropped off somewhere in the middle of nowhere, so Renee would have plenty of time to clear out. He had his doubts. He figured Renee was waiting for the next business day to get a human confirmation from his own bank that the money had arrived and was free and clear. Then he would dispose of Evan. For now, Evan was back in his cage, and the cage had been made escape-proof. The bars on the balcony were re-welded and reinforced, the fireplace flue was bolted shut, and the front door had sprouted two more deadbolts. Evan had nowhere to go except into the shower. So here he was. At last he got out and dried off using one of the bamboo shoot-patterned towels. The shock collar seemed to be waterproof. The tape holding Renee's fingerprint had all but sealed to the underside of Evan's arm, like a clear band-aid. The plastic trash bag had been replaced in its spot near the toilet. The only person who'd seen him use it to thwart the collar was Nando, and he hadn't survived long enough to tell anyone. Evan tried to take solace in this shred of an advantage. His clothes remained balled on the floor where he'd kicked them off. He'd been searched well. but Rene's men hadn't thought to check beneath the insole of his left boot, where he'd hidden the piano wire. They'd transformed his room into a dungeon, and all he had was a trash can liner and a loop of piano wire. He reminded himself that despair was not a luxury in which he could indulge right now. He dug the Rome Zone out from the pocket of his dirty jeans and studied the cracked screen, wondering where the boy was and what he was going through right now. He recalled the boy's scared voice, his words distorted over a swollen lip.
"So what? I get beat up all the time."
Evan looked at the four walls that held him. Being trapped was one thing. Being kept from helping a kid who needed him was nearly intolerable.
"You should see how they keep us here. Like cattle, all lined up."
And Allison Siegler. The Horizon Express would be nearing the locks of the Panama Canal by now, where her cries would be drowned out by the massive gates, the roaring culverts, the grinding machinery of the chambers. Every minute Evan was in Renee's hands brought her closer to her destination. She was 8 days from delivery. Frustration raged, a blade-winged bird beating inside Evan's chest. He forced himself to breathe evenly, to calm the bird, to focus. He headed out of the bathroom and into the walk-in closet. He was just pulling on some clean clothes when he heard a rumbling from outside. He rushed across the room and out onto the balcony, hard snow pelting him. The lights beneath the eaves bathed the front of the chalet in an alien glow that leaked around the corner. No one was in sight. He heard the noise louder now, powerful engines roaring off the walls of the valley. Straining, he peered through the bars. The steel slats had been tripled, slicing his view into fissures. The gravel road was blocked from view. He breathed, and he waited. At last, an enormous moving truck edged into sight as it turned into the circular cobblestone driveway and passed from his field of vision. And then another. Another. The last parked with its rear still visible. Workers coalesced at the back of the truck around the rolling door. It rattled up on creaky tracks and banged, dislodging a shelf of ice from the roof. Several of the men hopped inside, and a moment later an enormous flat item, sized like a barn door and ensconced in protective wooden crating, emerged. The workers lowered it from the truck, laboring under its weight, and staggered out of view toward the porch. Evan realized now why Rene had chosen not to knock him out with halogenated ether. He wanted Evan to witness this, whatever this was. The workers came back for another like-shaped object. Evan wondered just what the hell it was. A few minutes later came a different kind of ruckus from deep inside the chalet. Saws revving and power screwdrivers and the screech of rent metal. Construction noises. Evan returned to his room, put his ear to the sturdy front door and listened for a while. After a time his legs grew sore, so he sat with his back to the door. An hour passed, and then another, the clamor never subsiding. A few times he nodded off, but the sound was piercing and irregular enough to avert sleep. The dread gathering in his stomach didn't help either. He watched the first light of morning filter through the bars. It crept across the floor inch by inch. It had just reached his toes when he heard the moving trucks rumble away. A blissful moment of silence followed. Then the electricity hit, flame erupting around his neck, shooting tendrils of heat through his jaw and down into his chest. The shock flattened him to the floorboards. It continued, feeding Evan a steady current of pain. Somewhere beneath the static, he realized that these were the new procedures before anyone entered his room. Rene was taking no more chances. Sure enough, a moment later the door swung open, shoving his body aside. Dex reached down and gathered him up. 46. All the Honey. Dead on his feet, Evan stumbled along the corridor a few paces ahead of Dex, a collared dog being taken for a walk. Instead of a leash, Dex had only to hold the transmitter up. A tap of his finger would send Evan to the floor. They passed the library and then the sunroom. Every step heightened Evan's curiosity and his concern. What torture device had Rene built for him? When they passed through the doorway into the ballroom, Evan was shocked into stillness. He gaped at the item that had been constructed in the dead center of the vast space. A rectangular box the size of a cargo shipping container, built of what seemed to be bullet-resistant glass, probably Lexan or another sturdy-as-hell thermoplastic polymer. A freestanding room, nearly seamless, save for a small vent in the back befitting a reptile terrarium. A hatch resembling a bank vault's door had been cut into one end of the rectangle, swung ajar on massive industrial hinges. The heavy door looked to be a solid foot thick, as were the walls. Embedded below the steel bar handle was an inset screen and a sensor panel the size of a frisbee. Rene stood proudly in front of the Lexan vault, his surviving guards lined up behind him like White House staff awaiting a new president. Rene nodded at the open door, and Dex prodded Evan forward. As Dex shoved Evan across the threshold, his shoulder skimmed the frame. The corner sliced right through the fabric of his shirt, as sharp as the lasered edge of a carbon steel plate. Evan stood inside, the air compressing around him as Dex pushed the door closed. It clanked sonorously, and everything grew suddenly quiet. Dex pressed his left hand to the frisbee-size panel. The inside of the door featured a matching panel and screen, both of which now lit up. The panel displayed the outline of Dex's hand along with the network of veins running beneath the skin. A word glowed to life on the screen above. Match. Next, a series of commands populated the screen. Lock. Open. Disable. Recode. The lock button highlighted as Dex touched its counterpart outside, and lugs slotted into place, locking the door and sealing Evan inside. No cords or wires were in evidence anywhere in the clear Lexan around the instrument panels. The system was run by an internal battery, a safeguard against the powers being cut. Rene observed Evan studying the controls. "The vein patterns beneath the surface of our skin are as unique as our fingerprints," he said. "This system uses infrared sensors to identify those patterns. Something about hemoglobin absorbing the light? It's all too clever for me to keep up with. What I do know is that you will never crack out of this box." "So this is where I live now?" "No, I'm just testing it." "For what?" Rene drew closer, facing Evan through the transparent door. "Remember when you said I would not be happy after you sent that wire?" A sly grin. "Well, I am happy." His voice, at a conversational pitch, came through clearly. The sensor panel also served the function of relaying their words through the foot-thick Lexan. "You indicated that bad things would follow. You were right. Bad for you. Good for me." Rene leaned in even more, his mouth close enough to the door that his breath clouded the Lexan. "I know who you are." A sudden cold seemed to fill the transparent box. "Who am I?" Evan asked. "Orphan X. The Nowhere Man." "You have me confused with someone else." "I was given all the buzzwords. A richly funded covert action program. Neutralized Tier 1 targets. CONUS and OCONUS operations." Rene's forehead wrinkled, or at least did its approximation of wrinkling. "The last two sound like sexual acts. They mean what, precisely?" "Google them." Rene smiled. I know we had a deal, but you've hardly shown consideration for our agreement. Killing my men, destroying my equipment. Why should I honor what you won't? Given what you did to my lab, I need even more funds to rebuild, to acquire new medical machinery, buy another doctor. All this time, I've been focused on what you have. Little did I realize that who you are is more valuable. Evan asked, "Who told you this about me?" "I have my sources." "These sources," Evan said, "they found you." Rene wet his lips. "I put out inquiries. Answers came back." "How did those answers come back?" Evan pressed. "Through an email associated with the bank account in which your money landed. Your highly private account at the end of your highly encrypted trail of wire transfers," Evan said. "Wonder how they got that information?" "No," Rene said. "I wonder how much they'll be willing to spend for you. I'm guessing it'll be a lot more than 27 million. "I don't doubt it," Evan said. "Do you know who you're dealing with?" "Not the initial party, but some of the others." Evan felt another plunge in the temperature of the Lexan vault. "Others. It seems you're a wanted commodity in many quarters. Once I received word of your secret identity, I explored the market. My subsequent correspondents were willing to communicate through more traditional, untraditional means. I managed to scare up a few more bidders." Rene lifted a finger and tapped the glass in front of Evan's face. "We're having an auction." "You might not want to stick your arm into that beehive." "But Evan," Rene said, already turning to leave, "that's where all the honey is." 47. Collision Avoidance. Evan stuck his head and torso into the fireplace like an auto mechanic, examining the new bolts, studying the flue damper. It didn't give even a millimeter when he pounded it with the heels of his hand. The Ninth Commandment dictated, always play offense. But he was running out of moves fast. He thought about what his last sortie had cost Despy. He could see the glow of Renee's iPad in her deep brown eyes, how her face had crumbled at the sight held up before her. He hit the flue even harder, the ring echoing up the closed-off chamber beyond. He kept striking the metal plate, unleashing frustration and rage until his knuckles ached. Jack came to him in a wisp of memory. "Good thinking, son. Damage the only weapons you got left." Evan stopped, breathing hard in the musk of the hearth, letting the throb in his hands subside. A faint noise reached him, and at first he thought it had been conveyed from somewhere inside the building through the chimney itself. But no, it was more distant. He drew himself out and listened carefully. A scraping sound. Not from the chalet, but from outside. He moved to the sliding glass door and stepped through into a blast of snow. It was late afternoon, the front edge of dusk made gloomier by bruise-colored clouds blotting out the sun. Squinting against the flakes, he peered through the dense bars toward the sound. It took a few moments, but finally several figures came visible about halfway between the chalet and the barn, forms laboring in the whiteness. He could make out only their outlines, but eventually it became clear that they were using shovels, their blades scraping against the ice. As the snowfall diminished, he noted four of them working away. Not digging. Clearing a space. He leaned closer, hands clenching the cold bars. The space, set a good distance from the buildings and any trees, looked to be about 10 meters by 10 meters. It struck him what they were making, and suddenly even the bite of the air couldn't cool the electric surge of panic rolling through him. He came inside, put his shoulders against the sliding glass door, and closed his eyes. Tilting his head back, he took a few deep breaths, trying to calm himself. The hissing from the air vent caught him off guard. His eyes flew open, and he gulped in a mouthful before realizing what he'd done. Already he felt the haze climbing into his head, the weight gathering on his eyelids. It was so much earlier than usual. Renee had been wise to vary the schedule, to make the gassing episodes unpredictable. Stumbling to the bed, Evan barely had time to curse his lack of preparedness before passing out. The vibration stirred him from a deep, dreamless sleep. He groped beneath his pillow, came out with the wrecked room zone. A familiar number flickered across the cracked screen, and then vanished. It took great effort to lift his head.
Yeah.
His mouth was bone dry, his tongue bitter, coated with a chemical aftertaste. The same hushed voice came through the line, barely audible over the poor connection.
Are you coming to get me?
Evan sat up. With mounting frustration, he looked at the new deadbolts, the welded cage of the balcony. He forced a swallow down his sandpaper throat.
No, I'm...
He was at a loss for how to complete the sentence.
Why won't you?
I can't right now. Static flared up, and Evan prayed the line wouldn't cut out. How fragile his connection to the world, to what his life had been.
Try, the boy said. You have to try.
I did. I am.
The girl said you take care of people who need help, the boy said. I should have known it was fake.
It's not fake, Evan said. I'm not fake. Crackling on the line rendered the boy's response inaudible. Evan made a fist, pressed it against his thigh. Hard. I just don't know how to help you right now.
It's all lies and stories, the boy said. No one saves anyone.
Breathing in powdered sugar and sunscreen at the Veterans Day parade, Jack's warm hand resting on Evan's coat hanger shoulder, Pavarotti's 9 high C's washing over them in the fire-warm study, the hard part is staying human. The view from the window of a dormer room that was his, and only his.
Yes, they do.
Evan couldn't remember the last time he'd gotten choked up. It felt bizarre, out of control. In the silence, he could hear the boy breathing across the phone.
You'll forget me, the boy finally said. Everyone does.
No, I won't. The voice grew even quieter, barely a whisper.
You have to remember me.
Heat burned beneath Evan's face. I will. The connection cut in and out, stealing the boy's words.
Have to. Be too late.
As Evan strained to hear, a noise came from outside, a resonant thumping. A sound he knew all too well. He threw his legs over the side of the bed, willed himself to stand. His knees felt wobbly, his skull filled with concrete. The noise grew louder, vibrating the walls, the floor beneath his feet, the flesh on his bones. He was unsure if the vice pinching his temples was a headache or just dread tightening its grasp on him. Listen, he said into the phone. Hold up. Just hang on. He dropped the room zone onto the bed and stumbled to the balcony. The frosty air hit him full force, but the snow had vanished, leaving the night as clear as glass. 2 glowing dots approached through the sky, 1 red, 1 green. Collision avoidance lights. The helicopter banked and set down on the patch of cleared ground between the chalet and the barn. A door swung open, and a man emerged onto the makeshift helipad, a black hood tied over his head. Bundled in a thick coat, Dex walked out to meet him. The Dobermans at his side barked and barked at the still-spinning blades. Dex untied the hood from around the man's head and tugged it off. Even in the faint light, Evan recognized the man. Tigran Sarkisian. The Great White Sark. An international private arms dealer. In Spetak in 2005, operating as Orphan X, Evan had killed Sark's brothers, his grown son, and six of his cousins. Sarkisian shrugged off the cold and ambled for the house, accompanied by one of Renee's narcos. The helicopter lifted off. Through the slits in the steel, Evan watched it coast into the endless blackness to the west. As it grew more distant, the sound of its rotors oddly grew louder, amplified off the walls of the mountain range, coming at him in stereo. Evan's stomach fell away as he realized that he was no longer listening to the first helicopter. He swung his head back toward the barn. There they were, the lights of the next approaching helo. A good distance behind were two more floating dots, one red, one green. And behind that chopper, two more lights, and then two more, and then two more. He let his eyes skim across the incoming flight path, an airborne highway a dozen helicopters deep, each holding someone eager to lay hands on the nowhere man. Alarm cut straight through the fog of the drugs, his mind suddenly alert, his skin prickling. He remembered the Rome zone on the bed, the live connection, the tendril of a lifeline connecting him to the boy. Running back inside, he snatched up the phone. Hello? I'm here. I'm here. He stared at the Rome zone, dead in his hand. The kid had hung up. 48. Some bizarre mating dance.
Our beautiful women were hung naked from crosses, you see, in Deir ez-Zor. My mother was child, but she remembered. She say they were glorious even in this horror. Proud and naked, long hair blowing like the mermaids.
The great white Sark paused to wet his lips. Evan sat on a folding chair inside the Lexan vault in the ballroom. Sark overcrowded a matching chair on the far side of the transparent door. Just two men having a conversation. He looked much worse than when Evan had seen him last. His grizzled stubble the color of frost, pouches hanging beneath his milky eyes. He was an old man now, well into his 70s, but the power contained in his bear-like body was still evident.
I have reclaimed this atrocity for my own use.
His lips parted, showing pitted yellow teeth.
The crucifixion. So painful you invented a word for it. Your word, excruciating, it comes from this. Out of crucifying, it means.
In his cold metal chair, Evan listened wearily. He had the gnawing sense of having traded roles, of finding himself in a situation befitting one of the people he'd devoted the past 6 years of his life to rescuing. Now he was the one captive and defenseless, ready to be sold to the highest bidder, just like Alison Siegler. The Lexan room was his own version of Intermodular Container 78653-B812. He'd received his visitors one after another, a newlywed outside the church, each potential buyer coming in to peruse the merchandise. At some early morning hour, Dex had roused him from bed with an electric shock to the neck and marched him downstairs to the ballroom. Dex had spread his left hand across the sensor panel to unlock the Lexan door, giving Evan a good view of the tattooed bloody scowl, a preview of things to come. Security measures had changed. Dex now wore a handgun strapped to his wide belt. The other narcos had added pistols too, in addition to their AKs. It was no longer just Evan they had to worry about. René had assembled a collection of the world's most lethal criminal masterminds, and even if he'd had his men strip-search all the buyers and transport them here blind and disoriented, beanbag shotguns were no longer gonna cut it.
"When I buy you," Sark continued, bringing Evan back to the claustrophobic present, "I will do this to you. Insert nails here."
He jabbed a too long fingernail into the underside of his wrist.
"A weak spot between bones of forearm. Nail go in nice and smoothly. Your feet also must be nailed to relieve strain on wrists. This will allow you to hang longer from cross. People, they die from..."
His hand circled the air, searching out a word. He muttered to himself before snapping his fingers.
"Asphyxiation. The arms grow tired. The chest and lungs, they overextend. This is when I will add a footrest to help you."
Pale light sheeted from the high-set windows, giving the ballroom the aura of a cathedral. Dex stood near the dilapidated piano, arms crossed, his shiny dome catching light, his face shadowed. Calvador guarded the room's entrance, the Kalashnikov slanted back over his shoulder, one thumb hooked behind a shiny gold rodeo belt buckle. The four remaining narcos had shuttled the buyers back and forth all day, supervising them and giving curt directives, an armed bed-and-breakfast staff. The snipers, Evan figured, were still in the hills, providing just-in-case oversight. Of the buyers who'd come to threaten him so far, he hadn't seen the party he dreaded most, Charles Van Sciver or one of his orphan representatives. Not that the guests Evan was receiving were pleasant.
"I want to savor every drop of your pain," Sark continued. "No dying of shock. No quick and easy heart attack. Sepsis is my preference for you. It takes longest time, provides most agony. I want to keep you for days. My record is 5.
He held up a calloused hand, fingers spread, in case Evan needed a visual aid.
"But you are strong. This I remember."
Standing seemed to take Sark some effort, his joints arthritic. He tapped the Lexan between them almost fondly, his mouth splitting in a grin, showing those pitted teeth once again.
"I am hopeful you will do much better."
Asim Alakim entered the ballroom, the glare from the windows falling across his shoulders, seemingly adding more weight. He limped toward the provided chair outside the Lexan vault, one shoulder permanently shrugged. He'd suffered nerve damage from all the explosions. In the summer of 2002, Evan had killed Asim's twin sister, triggering the car bomb she was transporting to a 4th of July parade in Virginia Beach. The early detonation had scattered her and her Dodge Neon across Interstate 264. Sadly, Asim had not been in the passenger seat. He'd been a busy boy that year, sending a natural gas truck into a synagogue in Tunisia and engineering a bus bombing in Karachi. American-born, he and his sister moved easily between nations, renting themselves out at exorbitantly high rates. Though ostensibly Muslim, they were not ideologues. They were devoted only to their bank balances. It was rumored that they'd even provided services to the CIA in Colombia. With great relief, Asim lowered himself onto the chair. He licked his chapped lips, showing chipped front teeth.
"Hello, nowhere man."
"Asim, you look tired." He sighed.
"All that traumatic brain injury. It's like football. After a while, you can't even tell the difference between a hard hit and a concussion. There are lesions in my brain now, they tell me. I don't have many years left. I've got all the money in the world and no time to spend it.
He gave a sheepish laugh, lifted a tremulous finger.
I have one thing to set right before I die, and I am willing to spend every cent I have amassed to that end.
I understand.
Do you? Do you understand what you've taken from me?
He leaned forward, elbows on knees, his jittering arms making his shoulders wobble.
Do you understand what you do?
Yes, I do what you do, but for better reasons.
I don't think so. Ayesha and I, we were pure. We understood our jobs, our motives. We never wrapped ourselves in dogma or morality, or became true believers of one stripe or another. We called it what it was.
He looked weary, so weary. His gaze grew loose, unfocused.
She was beautiful.
Yes, Evan said. She was.
I miss her every day. I was with her from conception. We grew together in the womb, two parts of one whole.
It's like missing a limb.
No. Like missing half of my body.
His smile showed off the uneven edge of the broken teeth.
I hope to teach you what that feels like. Missing half of your body, and being alive to know it.
He rose unsteadily. Halbador had to assist him on his way out. The widow Lakshmi Narayanan did not bother to sit on the provided chair. Thin and bird-like, she circled the Lexan vault, taking in Evan from every angle. Her sari, a luscious orange trimmed with gold and money green, swept the floor around her invisible feet. She seemed more an apparition than a human. Wiry gray hair framed her small, wrinkled face. Though she was in her 40s, she looked like a great-grandmother. She'd aged preternaturally after Evan had dispatched her husband with a cell phone packed with C4. He'd been a counterfeiter and launderer of epic proportion, an equal opportunity provider who'd cleaned for everyone from Punjabi cartel leaders to Muslim extremists. Despite being a financial and technological genius, Shankar Lakshmi Narayanan had been a gentle soul who eschewed violence. He left personnel and business disputes to his wife, who displayed no such reservations. She was said to prefer straight razors. In the background now, two of Renee's guards arranged folding chairs in rows on the stretch of hardwood before the Lexan vault, opening them and setting them down briskly. Snap clang, snap clang. The widow took another turn around the box, and Evan turned with her, keeping her in view. As she circled, he spun, like they were doing some bizarre mating dance. The guards continued to set up for the coming auction. Snap clang, snap clang. The quality of light had changed in the ballroom, afternoon fading into evening. With the exception of a single midday bathroom break, Evan had been inside these four Lexan walls since waking, breathing his own stale air. Renee had placed no restrictions on the buyers, and most of them had wanted to take their time with him. It had been a parade of prior missions, a Dickensian haunting, a this-is-your-life tour of Evan's past. The Nowhere Man, dragged from the shadows and placed on display inside a transparent box. It was his worst nightmare, stretched along an exponential curve that grew steeper with every visitor. He'd seen foes from all around the globe. The daughter of a Serbian war criminal. The Fortune 500 father of a serial rapist he'd erased in an early pro bono mission as the Nowhere Man. A Hong Kongese gangster looking to preempt a future visit. Everyone, it seemed, but the contingent that Evan feared most. Van Sciver and his happy band of repurposed orphans. Evan had stopped pivoting with the widow, but he could feel her predatory stare heating his back now, raising the hairs of his neck. Unease overtook him, and he spun on his heel. She was clasping the wall behind him in a sort of embrace, scarecrow arms spread, bone-thin fingers clutching the Lexan. Her stare bored a hole right through him. Keeping her eyes locked to his, she licked the glass, leaving a smudge, then licked it again. At last, she turned and walked out, Halbador rushing to her side to steer her to her room. Behind Evan, the guards finished placing the last of the chairs. Snap, clang, snap, clang. He drew in a deep breath, wondering if his day was over at last. A clopping of footsteps announced Rene's entrance. His suit, which looked to be a thick wool blend, bulged at the hip. It seemed even the master of the chalet was bearing a handgun beneath all that fine fabric. David hung on his arm, an ornament on display, with an e-cigarette wedged between his index and middle fingers. Evan wondered if they'd been in the parlor entertaining.
"We done?"
Evan hadn't spoken in hours, and his voice came out husky.
"Not yet," Rene said. "We have one final party, and they're very eager to see you."
Clasping his hands, he swiveled to the doorway. Escorted by Halbador and his AK-47, Candy McClure entered the room wearing a dark green halter dress, the dagger of the deep cleavage neckline plunging down between her breasts to her belly button. Orphan V. Back from the dead. Last he'd seen her, he'd locked her in a closet in the spillage of hydrofluoric acid, a little treat she'd intended for him. He'd heard her pounding on the door and screaming, but had been massively outnumbered, busy ducking bullets and trying to get to a not-so-fair maiden in distress. At Candy's side now was a dead leaf of a man, short and slight, with jaundiced skin and darting flat eyes. No doubt another orphan. David vaped off his e-cig, eyeing Candy.
"She is spectacular," he said. "Isn't she?"
Candy strode across the room on stiletto boots. She confronted Evan through the glass, legs spread, muscular thighs tensed. She reached for the halter at the base of her neck, untied it, and let the top of the dress fall forward, exposing her torso. Behind her, David gasped, one hand rising to cover his mouth. At first, Evan didn't understand. Then she turned. Whirling scars covered her back and shoulders. Evan stared at the ridges and fissures with disbelief. The seam of disfigurement ran nearly perfectly down her sides. She looked like a doll pressed together from two different molds. She swung back around, giving him her glorious front.
"Hello, X," she said. "We've been looking for you for a very long time."
49. Flicker of Coldness. Candy moved toward Evan, lifting her arms to retie the halter at the base of her neck.
"I didn't know that happened to you," Evan said. "Not like that."
She must have read something in his face, because he saw a flicker in her eyes, a softness shimmering through the gem-hard surface, but only for an instant.
"I'm not going to waste time telling you what I'm going to do to you," she said. "When the time comes, I'm just going to show you."
Rene said, "You're that confident you'll win the auction."
"It's not a matter of confidence," Candy said. "It's a matter of fact. Ain't that right, Em?"
The sullen little man gave no indication that he'd heard her, but Halbador read the shift in the air and hoisted his Kalashnikov to a low ready position. Dex moved around the perimeter of the ballroom, sidling into Orphan M's blind spot.
"You see," Candy said, "we're the only ones here with unlimited money."
Rene laughed. He didn't realize that she was being literal, that as the head of the orphan program, Van Sciver could access money directly off the U.S. Treasury's printing presses.
"In that case," Rene said,
I wish you the best of luck. Oh, we're not the buyer, Candy said. We're the delivery service. One of your conditions before we boarded your helicopter was that we leave all electronics behind. But one of our conditions is that you provide me a means to contact my buyer. You're not in a position to set conditions. I am not authorized.